we're going to roll into the second part of the old Radio Ranch RBN Sunday edition, and we got Joe from Oklahoma, and Joe Terry's behind us, but anybody that's named Terry in Texas has got good patience. I'm just self-assured. So what else can we do for you until we go talk
to
Terry?
Well, let me make one more comment. An old-timer friend of mine who's dead and gone is the one that got me to get my first passport, and I can't tell you how many years ago it was, but the reason he said you need to have one is, and it came up on the first one that I had, it says right on there that it was the duty of any law enforcement officer to help you on your way.
Yeah, right.
Remember
they're
that?
About foreign, you know, well, they're talking about foreign countries, but I, you know, whatever, yeah, no.
Well,
do you know why all this information's in the passport application, Joe? Have we gone over that?
Well, it's to cover their ass is what it is.
Well, in essence, to make the scheme constitutional, okay? After Watergate, there were two really important pieces of legislation passed that still affect us greatly in a positive way today. One of them is called the Paperwork Reduction Act. And the other was the FOIA Act, for Freedom of Information Act requests. You know who Tom Fitton and Judicial Watch is, right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Well, that's all they use is FOIAs. Everything they've done comes from Freedom of Information Act requests. That's all they do. And the reason they use it is because of that law. Now, every agency has a Freedom of Information Act officer, and you find out what that officer is, and you can go in there and get access to all this information because of Watergate. All right. And so that is invaluable. All right. The other thing was the Paperwork Reduction Act. And that said, any administrative agency that puts out any paperwork with a specific bureaucratic definition, it's called an information gathering request, where they're putting out some type of paperwork from the agency that gathers information from the public at large, a public information gathering request. And any paper that fits that criteria has to go through the Office of Management and Budget and be awarded. If it gets all the checks checked, it's got to be issued an OMB number, and they can't put out the paper to the public until it's got the OMB number and it passes all the constitutional muster. Okay? So yep. They have to put that information in there. It's not that they want to, and you can see they don't want to by the links they've gone through to hide it. Okay? Like, yep. This warning, like is on dangerous drugs. It's called a warning box label in the administrative state. They just don't have the box around it, but it's got the big warning. You can attach documentation, comma, including affidavits, comma, but you better not lie or we're going to hit you with 8 sections of the U.S. code. Well, that's your get out of jail free card, but they certainly don't pose it that way. They pose it in a, you better not do this or we're going to beat you over the head until you're senseless and dead. Okay. So, attach documentation? No, I'd never do that. Well, that's your get-out-of-jail-free card. But see how the links they've gone through to cover it here?
Sure.
This is how these bastards think, and it's how these satanic bastards work. And their handiwork is everywhere.
Yep. Roger, Terry wants to talk to you. I appreciate your time.
All right, Joe.
And I continue to listen, and your links and addresses and stuff, please be a little bit slower in getting them out and repeat them so folks like me can get them written down.
I try to do that. I mean, I'm an old radio guy, and there's so many times people rattle off a phone number. You go, hold it, man. I don't even have a pencil or paper here. And they're off on something else. So I'm conscious of that. I really try and do it. Okay, well, I understand, Joe. Well, listen, if you get with Eugene Schroeder and his buddy, please tell him I said hello and that I have greatly, greatly benefited from their work. And the one key thing that came out of Gene Schroeder's work on that's the Trading with the Enemies Act that people don't understand. There was a piece of legislation passed in 1917 in the middle of World War I, and they named the Germans as the enemy. And in 1933, they took that exact same legislation, and the only thing they changed, they took Germans out And they put citizens of the United States in. You've been the declared enemy of the
federal
government since 1933.
Title 12, United States Code, Section 95B, Money and Banking.
Well, you
that's
tell Dr. codified. Schroeder and his sidekick that I really appreciate their work, and tell them hello for me, if you would. And
that
turn them on to my
right
work.
Here.
Turn them on to my
God
work,
bless
because
you,
my work completes their work that they didn't understand.
Yep. God bless you, bud.
Okay, you too. Igualmente, as we say in Ecuador. Joe, we'll talk to you next time. Terry, front and center.
Oh,
Terry.
Hey there, Roger. Terry from
hey,
Texas,
Terry.
A.K.A.
Hey,
FEMA Region 6.
Okay.
The de facto little government over me, but
what town are you in FEMA Region 6?
I'm in Houston.
Okay. Oh, God, I'm sorry.
So, yeah, I'm just waiting on my passport and card to show up so I can go ahead and make my notifications. I was going to ask you as far as
This isn't Terry, our doctor buddy, is it?
Well, paramedic, uh-huh.
Okay, all right.
And so I was trying to – I've got a list of about 20 agencies I've got to notify, put on notifications. So,
oh, boy.
You know, yeah, the counties I travel through and all the agencies within those. So I'm going to do that. As far as doing those notifications, do I have to send, return notice to each one of them?
I think just to cover yourself, it'd be wise to spend an extra couple of bucks and get certified return receipt request and put it in your file.
Yeah.
Because it just completes the fact that you gave them notice, they received it, and I got the paper. You lying sack of administrative
poop. That's my next venture.
You
know, I was looking on YouTube. I was looking at I don't know who this young man is, but he put together a
Presley. Presley.
Wow, he did a great job, and he gives total kudos to you. He also links your radio show and all your archives. He actually has
18 years old.
Yeah, and the name of this video, it's called American Citizenship and the Constitution. It's a beginner's guide, and it goes through quite a bit. So if anybody has any questions, if they can't get answered on your show, that'd be a great start.
Presley comes on our show. Presley comes on the show quite often, and he had his mom on one day, Sonny. And they told me he's got two younger brothers that are sharper than he is.
Well, he does an excellent job in this video. Yes, I mean, it goes through the 13th and 14th Amendments and goes through some case law in the Supreme Court, how this all is justified. And so it's and again, it links back to all your sites you links to documents from the IRS
guess what, his daddy's a lawyer too.
Well, that you can sure tell, because he's gone into the legal aspects really good, and it's pretty minimum for the time it's on there, and really good link for people. So I had a question. I seem to have run into a dead end. I want to basically, I'm looking for a suppressor for my weapon. And, the ATF and the NFA, National Firearms, documents basically state the conditions as you have to be a resident. And
I
don't know how to go about making a purchase or what.
Well, you're not a resident anymore. So here's.
Right.
I've got one real-life example that Daryl, our good listener, good student Daryl, had a number of years ago. After he got his feet on the ground here and he's starting to press the envelope a little bit, he lives outside of Gadsden, Alabama, pretty small town, a lot smaller than Houston. And so it's one of those towns where everybody knows, most people know each other, even though he's recently moved there in the last so many years. He still knows some of those folks. They had a local gun shop there, and he had purchased guns previously there before he'd made this change. And evidently it's one of those gun shops where you walk in and there's a table back in the back, and all the guys from town sit around and talk about weather, politics, and women, that kind of thing, drink coffee. And so he walks in and he goes up to the guy, he's dealt with him before, and he goes, "I want to buy a shooting iron." That's the way he talks. I want to buy a shooting iron, and he picks one out, and he goes to complete the sale, and he's got to do the background check, obviously. And so he fills it out, and he says U.S. National on it. And he hands it to the clerk, and the guy goes, they won't let me sell it to you. And Daryl goes, well, just humor me, okay? And reluctantly, the guy calls the background check line, and he says, gets the question, you know, whatever the guy on the other end. He said, well, he says he's a national. And the FBI check guy goes, well, wait a minute. He goes away for a short time, comes back, says, yep, sell it to him. And he said everybody in the store's jaw dropped to the floor because he'd been telling them about this, see, and they didn't believe
him. Well, you know, that's kind of what I'm getting. I talked to the seller and I talked to the kiosk who does the transaction, and both of them said they won't do it. And I said, well, let me do a little research here because I don't see where they would be able not to because you are a legal entity. So
you know,
I think
Perry,
I'll just go and have them do the same.
It's kind of like when you and I were young and we were dating a lot, right? All they can say is no.
Right. And I think that's what I'll do because it doesn't really give you, you know, the two questions to check on the box are, have you denounced your U.S. citizenship and are you a resident?
No, so, absolutely not. I hadn't done any expatriation. I've repatriated to what you've been hiding from us.
I agree with you on that, but it doesn't make that statement. So what I think I'm going to do is just check both no and have him make the call to the NFA person and just see what their answer is.
All they can say is no. All they can say is no, don't sell it to him. And I don't think they will, you know. I don't think they will. There's some court precedent on this I saw a while back when I was looking into it. And, yes, it's very interesting because it came out of Hawaii with an American Samoan. And they had to sell it to him. They had to sell it to the American Samoan, too, and he is only a national unless he's naturalized.
Right. And I see where they will sell it to the green card citizens, but there's nothing in there about, you know, just a state national.
They'll probably sell it to all them illegals that are coming over the border and flooding you guys down there.
Absolutely, if you got a green card, you know, and you're here legally. So, I haven't been able to get that answer, so I think I'm just going to go there and see what the answer from the NFA is.
You know what I tell a lot of my students is we'll never know the answer to some of these questions until somebody presses the envelope like you're talking about doing. And then we know the answer, you know?
Right. You know, I've noticed a lot of information. There's a lot of groups that are being very successful at putting these groups of state nationals together.
Well, they...
There's one. I don't have it in front of me, but they've got a lawsuit going against this group, and she's put them in the trick bag. And so I don't have it in front of me.
Is this one of Anna's groups?
It might be.
If it's got state assembly attached to it, it's one of Anna's groups. And my problem with Anna and David Strait and the other people that are out, I don't have a problem with them teaching, obviously. We want all the help we can get. But I'm so fortunate because John Benson was my law teacher, and I understand what's going on, and I knew before I knew anything else that we were in the feudal system already. And that's the key thing. If you don't know you're fighting the feudal system, as my teacher Glenn Ambort said, you'll never do anything but shadow box with it because you don't know what you're fighting. Yeah. Their disabilities are that they not only don't know what they're fighting, they don't even know the system of law that's being used. And on top of that, they don't understand things like the legal concept behind the meaning of the word person, which is what I spent about an hour and 45 minutes on yesterday on that show that you can access over at castbox.fm, search Radio Ranch. It'll be the latest one at the top. And that I just can't tell you how important that information is. Okay, this is the stuff they don't teach in law school and haven't for a long time. Let me tell the audience that might not have heard of this story, okay, because it's very instructive. So my law teacher, John Benson, studied law all his life simply because he loved it. right? And he didn't go to law school. He'd study out of the old law books. In fact, he had one of his friends was an airline pilot who had the London route. And when you got a long flight like that, they always allow the captain and the crew to have a day rest at the layover stop, and then they fly back, okay? And so this guy would have frequent days off in London, and he'd go through all the old bookstores and buy all these old law books and bring them back to John, okay? And so he's schooled in all this stuff like Gaius, who was the person in Rome that's originated, credited with originating the law, G-A-I-U-S, if you want to look it up. Hold on, Joe, I'll repeat it again. Mm-hmm. G-A-I-U-S, Gaius. And he wrote a group of books called Gaius's Institutes. These are the first books written on the law, okay? And the whole part of Gaius's Institutes at the first is on the legal concept behind the word person. You think it might be important?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, they don't teach that in our law schools anymore. So John, at one point, I don't know, he's living in Salt Lake. He was a devout Mormon. And I don't know if he called Utah State or Utah University or one of the other peripheral ones out there, but he did. He called the law school and got the dean on the phone. Okay? So he's talking to the dean about coming back potentially to law school. And so he's talking with him. Dean goes, oh, man, we'd love to have you, and you know, this, that, and the other. And John goes, well, you know, I'm particularly interested in the word person. And the dean goes, oh, no problem. We teach that in an elective course called jurisprudence. And when we get enough students signed up for it, we teach it. And
no,
John said,
sign me up.
and John goes, when was the last time you taught it? And the dean goes, 6 years ago, six graduating law classes went through his law school and not ever got exposed to the legal meaning concept behind the word person. And person, you know, all laws are written for persons, things, or actions. The majority, vast majority, for persons. And you don't understand the legal concept behind that?
Oh, yeah.
You're in bad trouble, buddy. You're going to go fight these guys, and you don't even know the word person? You got big problems.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Say, let me ask you, what would be the alternative to resident?
Domicile, sojourner. You could use the word. See here, now this is, you bring up some really good questions, all right? If you go to Webster's, there's two, they're even Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, not a law school, not a law dictionary. There's more than two, but the first two definitions are very instructive. Definition A says the act or fact of living or dwelling in a place for some time. That's the one they're wanting you to bite on. That's the geographical one. Underneath it is the same exact thing. The act or fact of living or dwelling in a place for some time for the receipt of a benefit or the discharge of a duty. This is in Webster's Collegiate Dictionary. Okay, that's the one they're pinning on you. Now, when I was getting into this stuff, when you get into this stuff, as I was years ago, there's a group of books in the law library called Words and Phrases, which is a really, really helpful group of books for reference stuff and research. Because what that group of books does is it goes through all these court cases and it pulls out key words and key phrases, and they compile them under the word or the phrase and give you every court site. Okay? Wow. So you can go back and key in on one word and have a wealth of return information. And I went to the Cobb County Law Library there in Cobb County, Georgia, and went in, found words and phrases, looked under resident, and one of the court cases said, whenever the word resident is used in any legal context, its definition is always legal.
Put you back in
always.
The de facto. Yeah. Is there anybody else on the line?
Somebody else just called in, but that's all right. They can wait just a second. Now, my important point I was going to get to is, with that background there, when you file an affidavit, you come and fall under God's laws, right?
Exactly.
So if you want to apply those definitions, well, where you get your benefits and owe your duties is your residence. So when you file this affidavit, where's your residence?
In the state, I would imagine.
How about heaven?
Well, that too, God given.
Okay. So yep. That's why it's super important to understand these underlying, gigantically important concepts.
Yeah.
And you're not going to do that without a little study, you know?
Citizen, person, and resident, they love to use them.
Yeah. For resident, once you do that, once you file this, you can use domicile.
Domicile, okay. So I don't know. I was talking to you about these sites. I don't know who the Patriot Princess is, but this is
Gosh, me either.
The website is theconstitutionalcommando.com or Constitutional Commando, and it's the state versus Patriot Princess, state of Minnesota. They tried to close her down for these mandates for COVID, and she sued the governor under this emergency order. Anyway, it gives you the link to where they are and how she's basically put them in a common law court.
Okay. Well, good for her. If she's having some success in that arena, I'll tip my hat to her.
Yeah, I'll have to, there's a 6-minute video that shows you where they are, and they keep pushing, and their whole thing is, this will probably go from this court to a higher court, and the higher court has to rule in her favor just because of jurisdiction. And so,
well, maybe. Should be interesting. Maybe. It determines on how infiltrated the judiciary in that state. I.e., I heard Robert Barnes talking the other day, who I've got a man crush on, by the way. Robert Barnes talking about Connecticut. And Alex Jones's trial up there, he said he ain't getting any satisfaction at the appellate level and probably the Supreme Court level either, and that case will eventually end up at the Supreme Court of the United States because Connecticut's so damn corrupt.
But is he a state citizen? Is he a state...
No, he doesn't know anything about this. If he was, he wouldn't be in there in the first place.
Well, this lady does. See, that's the advantage. She does.
Well, she might know about it, but has she effectively... changed, I mean, there's example, Anna tells her people to send their paperwork to the Secretary of State of the state. Well,
I don't know if this is connected to her, but this person has obviously done that because they put themselves in common law court, so I'm assuming that they're
They say they've put themselves in common law court. There is no distinction. If you go into a state court, because here's the underlying principle. All property law is state law, I would add, without the exception of the 14th Amendment, where they made you property, that very few people understand. Okay, but generally, all state law, property law is state law. So in their courts, they will have the common law jurisdiction there, and the judge can wear two hats, but it depends upon the circumstances. And most of the time, they probably won't defer unless you've got your act totally together. If this gal in Minnesota is in a state assembly and she filed her paperwork with the Minnesota Secretary of State, she ain't doing nothing but spinning her wheels. I'm telling you now.
Right. You have to set your precedent in the court as a common law citizen or common law.
You got to set the precedent with the Secretary of State of the United States. He's got exclusive jurisdiction over all matters concerning citizenship because he issues passports. And he's got to know your legal personality before he's going to issue a passport. That's why they hid this whole scheme at the Secretary of State. That's why Eustace Mullins says in Secrets of the Federal Reserve, the minute they got the Federal Reserve Act passed, the very first cabinet position they went after, Secretary of State. Why? Because he's the guy. They knew the monetary system they were going to bring in, and they know he's the key guy.
Right, but from what I'm reading of this case, she has already attained state citizenship.
Okay, well, I hope so for her sake. Maybe she can get some kind of precedent going, and I wish her the best and Godspeed. But I'd have to know exactly what she's done to know whether she's really in the position to do that accurately.
Right. Well, I think she is. I'll get back to you on it. But I believe they've already gone through the process, so.
Okay.
Anyway, I'll get off and let whoever else
All right.
on. Thank you, Roger.
Okay, Terry. Well, nice to talk to you again. Good questions. Good discussion, Terry. Be a comeback and do it again, okay? I guess Terry's gone. Who's next? I know somebody phoned in there, Sam. Paul in New York. I think I might know this guy.
You think so?
I think
maybe.
Can
you hear me? 'Cause Because no, you're loud and clear. Skype is doing something really weird.
Nah,
Skype still thinks I'm ringing.
Well, you're wall to wall.
Okay. Well, Skype still thinks I'm calling you. It says connecting. God save Microsoft. You know, I've got
a
question.
What do you expect when Bill Gates takes something over?
Yeah, right. Well, I kind of had a thought. You know, when you were talking to your last caller, I got a great memory. It's just really, really short. Was that
Terry.
Joe?
Terry. Oh, Joe.
Terry. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, I had Terry, yeah. And Joe was before that, and you could call him Joe Dale, but we'd rather call him Joe. So go ahead.
Okay. Well, Terry's question was, if he goes in and he tries to buy a firearm and they won't sell it to him.
Well, he was talking about a suppressor. He wasn't talking about a firearm. He's talking about a suppressor. Now, a lot of people in Texas use suppressors. You know why, Paul?
Why's that?
Because all those wild pigs out there, and they can drop a bunch of wild feral pigs with a suppressor if they don't have a suppressor on there, or the rest of them scatter.
Right. Okay. Well, then I don't know. Now, if they denied him sale of a firearm because of his political status,
They won't do that because nationals can purchase firearms. They won't deny him. Daryl's example shows you that. But they'd like to. They don't want to think anybody's found their little secret out, but their little secret's out, you little slaving bastards.
Yeah, but I would think an accessory for a firearm would fall under the same category.
Probably so.
I would think. But now what that said to me was, doesn't that smack as a violation of U.S. Code Title 18, Section 242? It's a denial of rights under color of law.
Well, you're talking hypothetical stuff. They're not going to turn him down, but I guess it could be if you can find an honest court to take somebody to in the federal system.
Yeah, it's deprivation of rights under color of law because he has a right to protect himself, and he has a right to do so quietly.
Yeah, he's got a right to go shoot feral pigs too if he wants to. He might be hungry.
Yeah.
Nobody in Texas should starve because, buddy, this is a plague. I mean, you know, you can go on YouTube and they got videos. They're even hunting them with helicopters now. You can go out there and pay somebody to fly you around in a helicopter and shoot these pigs because they want them gotten rid of.
Mm-hmm.
They're terrible for farmers. They root everything up. They ruin stuff. You know, they got it's a huge problem out there, from what I understand.
Well, they got to be kind of gamey, aren't they?
You know, well, are you hungry?
Well, yeah, kind of. No, finished a bowl of popcorn listening to the first hour of your show.
But. Well, if you get real hungry, you may eat gamey pig, you know?
Well, you know, that's true. That's true. Hey, I was on Captain Fred's show. I called into that one a couple of times. He's got the slot right before you. And we were talking about the 14th Amendment. We were talking about some of the things you teach, though not as well or eloquently as you do. But I did point anyone that was listening to the matrixdocs.com so they can catch
Good
some
deal.
Of the backstory. And
yeah,
hopefully some of them hung in for this show. You know,
well, I hope so.
You took over from him. But you've had some really, really good questions today, and I'm really sorry
I missed the
show yesterday.
Oh, it's up on CastBox. It's a real good show. It was really good, and I love doing those things because these basics, I mean, I cannot express how important they are to your understanding and to your complete mastery of because, believe me, you're going to be knowing a whole bunch of stuff that a whole bunch of attorneys in this country don't know. That's why we have so much attorney problems with the legal field. They weren't taught this stuff in law school. They're taught not to think outside the box, and they're not taught the right fundamental stuff generally. I'm sure there's some places that do. But the example I would give to you here, to the audience and you, Paul, happened before I left the country. So this is 15, 16 years ago. All right, I'm in Florida, and the phone rings. And I answered, and it's some attorney from Nebraska or Iowa, somewhere in the Midwest. And he had a client with an IRS problem who had heard me or knew of me or something and somehow got my phone number. I still don't know how they did that. Anyway, so he's asking me, and I go into the whole explanation of the three different types of regulations and what the differences are and what it means and all that stuff. Excuse me. And when I got finished, he made a statement that shocked me. He said, "Roger, you know more about this than 98% of the attorneys in the country."
Yep, and after the break, I think it would be a great thing for you to actually explain the difference between laws of agency and laws that apply universally.
Well, laws of agency only applies to people that are in an agency relationship. It's real easy. You know, if you're a real estate agent or an insurance agent, you fall under those laws. And that's why, because all these things are bureaucratic, and everybody that's in the state of New York is connected back to the attorney general in the laws of agency. They're agents of that in that county. And so you're locking them in when you do this notice and you copy, you send it to the attorney general of your state, the fact that this document's on file with the Secretary of State of the United States. He's an attorney general. If he doesn't know what that means, there's a great legal phrase, known or should have known, that applies to him, okay? And so you put down at the bottom, you copy your legal people, and you send them the exact same paperwork with that notice to the principal's, notice to the agent, notice to the agent's, notice to the principal. Now they're all locked together under the laws of agency. That's why that's important. So should your DA docket a speeding ticket, well, they're both, the attorney general and the DA are now personally liable because they're in agency and they violated their jurisdictional statements. They're acting outside of it. When they act outside of their delegated responsibilities, they lose their immunity. It's that simple.
Right. Well, what I'd like you to clarify is why a statute, an act, or a code doesn't apply to nationals. Why it doesn't.
Well, some of them do, some of them don't. You know, if you go into the United States Code, they'll tell you at the front whether it's positive or non-positive law. If it's positive law, it applies to nationals. If it's non-positive law, it probably doesn't. So you got to look at the title.
And non-positive law would be like an agency law. It only applies to like employees.
Well, maybe that's a good topic to cover here. We got one or two people in line, but it's a good teaching moment. Okay, so here's what happens. You can go to the government printing office today, and you can order a book called How Laws Are Made. And it goes over this process. Not like I'm going to go over it, but it goes over the basic process. So normally, a law originates in the House or the Senate, and once it passes that House, it has to pass the other House. And if the bills don't agree, like carbon copy, then they go into conference committee. You've heard about going into conference committees. And they go in there and slug it out, and they come up with something that's agreeable to both parties where it does agree. When that's done, it goes to the president. He signs it. At that point, it goes over into that group of law books that's got the dust all over the top of them because nobody ever goes over there. And it's called the Organic Statutes at Large. Statutes at Large. Those are the organic laws of the United States of America. And when a piece of legislation goes into there, it's considered to be constitutional. The key word, considered. Okay? Now, that's over there in the Organic Statutes at Large. By the way, if you do go over there, that set of books, and you open up Volume 1, and you open up the front cover, you find the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, the Northwest Territory Ordinances, and the Constitution. Those are at the front on the inside cover of the organic laws of the country. You think they don't apply anymore? They wouldn't put them in there if they didn't. Okay. And so at that point, it's considered to be constitutional. Now they drag them over to the second group of law books called the United States Code, 50 titles. The Roman civil law is actually what it is because they're melding. They're melding merchant law in with constitutional law. And that's where you get that positive and non-positive law identification. And you'll see a checklist of all the 50 titles. I forget exactly if it's in every one of them or if it's in Volume 1. But when you're at the very first, and they'll have which ones are positive law and which ones are non-positive law. Okay. Now, the difference is if they take a law from that organic statutes at large and bring it over to the United States Code whole cloth, then that's a positive law title. If they bring it over and they monkey with it, or if it's an example like Title 26 that I'll cover here in a minute, everybody's favorite, if they bring it over piecemeal and they make sausage out of it, then it's non-positive law. Title 26 is non-positive law because Title 26, the Internal Revenue Code, was never passed by the Senate and it was never signed by the President. It was only passed by the House of Representatives, and it shows up in the United States Code as Title 26. How'd that happen?
Magic.
Oh, yes, it is. It's satanic magic. Because we're talking about a federal zone, the federal income tax, it only has to be passed by the House because the House has exclusive jurisdiction over D.C. As much as this should make you shiver like a dog passing a persimmon seed, okay? Nancy Pelosi runs D.C.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, there's a third group of law books in the law library, and those are called the Code of Federal Regulations. There's 50 of them, too. Each one of those titles attaches to one of the titles in the code via subject matter. So all these people, I want to vote. My representative, your representative ain't doodly squat. James Traficant got up in front of Congress when he was still a member and told the entire assembled House of Representatives, ladies and gentlemen of the House, we're nothing but trustees overseeing the largest bankruptcy in the history of the world. So they pass legislation, it goes from the statutes at large over the United States Code, piecemeal or wholemeal, then it's transferred down to the appropriate administrative agency, which deals with that subject matter, and the bureaucrats there can rewrite it sometimes 180 degrees in the opposite direction of the original legislation. There's where the meat is in the administrative agencies.
Right.
And of course, the only people that those apply to are the serfs. So if you want to stay under man-made bureaucratic regulation promulgation, you just don't file an affidavit. It doesn't matter to me.
So what's the significance of notice and comment?
I damn sure matter to you, though. What?
Yeah. So what's the significance of notice and comment, and what effect does that have?
Well, that's the different types of regulations, and the significance of notice and comment, there's three types of regulations: statements of policy, interpretive regulations, and substantive regulations. And the substantive regulations are the only one of the three that has to go through the additional step of due process in a process called notice and comment. If you look in the Federal Register, which is the legal organ of the federal government, all these things have to be put in there: notice and the right to be heard. Okay, and so they're adhering to that. But this substantive regulation has an additional due process clause because it's so important, and the reason for that is because those apply to general population. Okay, they call it general applicability. That applies to everybody. The other two don't. So because they apply to everybody, they've got an additional layer of due process, and you can go see it in the Federal Register if you want to look in there. At the heading of the regulation, it'll say notice of proposed rulemaking. They cite the regulation. There's a contact person at the bottom of the regulation, and it says you got so many days, 60, 90 days, whatever they put in there, to get your comment into them. Supposedly, in the purest administrative state realm, they will take your comments into consideration, reformulate the regulation, and it comes back and it says notice of final rulemaking. And that's the final regulation. And they don't have the contact person down there anymore. They got how many days it's got before it takes effect. Okay? And they can't take effect on a substantive regulation until 30 days after that expires, I believe. It's been a long time since I've looked at it. But here's the real big difference when it applies to us and this time slot I've got on RBN. Okay? All IRS regulations were interpretive. None of them that any, my Ralph or myself have ever found, went through notice and comment. And those regulations only apply to the IRS internally. That's what they're using on everybody. So I know there's no attorney that wants to continue to be an attorney that's going to bring that argument up representing some IRS client. Okay. Now, you may do it pro se, but to my knowledge, nobody's ever brought that into a district court. This regulation can't apply to me because it was only interpretive. Now, where have we seen the parallel of that recently? It was in Florida on the CDC mask case, because that's the basis that she overturned that mask requirement. It was only an interpretive regulation by the CDC. Only CDC employees had to wear a mask, but they put it on everybody. And that district court, that's the finding. She, by the way, she was one of Clarence Thomas's law clerks. It was a female judge down there. Okay. And so what is Merrick Garland, the fake, the Jew that changed his name, Merrick Garfunkel? What the hell does he say? Oh, we're going to appeal that. Yeah? Let's see you appeal it, big boy. You're going to appeal it to your Reingold judge that signed the magistrate, that signed the Mar-a-Lago search warrant, that used to work for Jerry Epstein for the pilot and represented the plane? Is that who you're going to get to hear that case there, Garfinkel? God, I hate these bastards. I hate you, you son of a bitches. Your son's a Satan. Put me on your hate list.
My next question, how many of the statutes, acts, and codes that have ever been written, passed, or written into law, how many of them only apply internally to the corporate U.S.?
You'd have to go back and look at the individual regulation. Now, when you go to the Code of Federal Regulations, you start looking at this stuff. Okay. I can't answer your question simply, Paul. At the bottom of the regulation, if it's a reformation of a previous regulation, in brackets, not in parentheses, in brackets, they'll have the previous regulation. So you can go to what you want to go to a federal depository. That's a law library that's got all this stuff in it. And you want to go back and start tracing these regulations back. Now, the way I stumbled on this was when these bastards were coming at me with a summons for books and records. And my teacher taught me all this stuff, hammered it into my head, as you can tell. During that period of time, and I'd go down Georgia State in downtown Atlanta was a federal depository in Emory, but it's easier for me to get to Georgia State, but it's right downtown Atlanta, and all this stuff's on microfiche there. They don't have the books, but they're there. And so I started tracing back this notice, the summons for books and records, and I'd start chasing back the earlier regulations, and every regulation always ends, guess where? The internal code of 1954, the one they put into play 60 days after Brown v. Board when they equalized the statuses. So, and Ralph found the same thing. We didn't communicate, but he got on this too. He probably did a better job of researching it than I did. But I guarantee you, there's no IRS regulation that's ever gone through notice and comment. How can I make that guarantee for you? Because I know it's a voluntary system.
Right. So I would think that every single statute, act, and code that they have written were written administratively. They're not laws that apply universally to every living man or woman.
No, and regulations are called little laws. That's what they call them, little laws. They're not Congress laws. They're little laws by big bullshit Democrats or bureaucrats.
Yeah, the widow was.
Jeez. You know where that term came from? Bureaucrat?
Where?
The French Revolution. Uh-huh. After that, it's the first time they installed, they might have been pioneered in Rome, but it's the first time they really applied it. After the French Revolution, and the new bureaucrats, you could identify them because they had burlap on their desks. And in French, burlap is bureau, and that's why they call them bureaucrats.
Uh-huh. So they write all kinds of statutes, acts, and codes, and they say they apply to everybody, but they don't.
They don't write statutes and codes. They promulgate regulations.
Okay. That's they all promulgate regulations, and they tell people that they apply to everybody equally.
But they don't. They're pulling the wool over your eyes. Gosh, I'm sure you're surprised.
Paul,
listen.
Totally.
Before we get around in time here, and we can have this conversation over on our show if anybody wants to come join this kind of conversations we have over there, and you're welcome to, but I want to make sure these folks that have called in don't get hung out to dry at the end. So thanks for calling, Paul, and I'll yak with you tomorrow. Mañana en la mañana.
All right, Roger. Thank you. Okay. Take care.
All right. Ciao, ciao. Who's next, Sam? Oh, Abilama. Hey, Keith.
Hey, Roger. Good to be hearing you again.
Well, good. I'm glad to be talking again. You know, every day you get out of bed and you're erect is a good day. I mean, standing straight up. Don't take me wrong.
It's not a bad day.
What part of the state are you in, Keith?
Never a bad day. If you put your feet on the ground and breathe in air, it's a good day.
I guess that's right. Should be, anyway. What part of Abilama are you in?
Rocket City.
Oh, up in the Huntsville area.
Yes, sir.
Ah, the jumping off board of Sean Hannity.
I've been listening to your show. I've been meaning to call in, but before I get in, I've been listening to your show. You was talking about persons a while ago.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay. Now, a man can be a person.
Yes.
But a person can never be a man.
No, that's incorrect.
You think so?
No, I know so. Okay.
Wait a minute. I
would say no. It can be, but not necessarily. A person, right. A legal person, we're not talking about persons colloquially, we're talking about legal persons, okay? And a person is an entity to whom the law ascribes rights and duties. So what person you are depends upon what body of law is ascribing you your rights that you owe correlative duties to. Okay? So a person can be a trust, can be a partnership, can be a corporation, and it can also be an individual. But they identify an individual person as an individual. A human person is identified in law as an individual. And the reason for that is because the rights and the duties are in the same entity. In a corporation, the rights and duties are split. The corporation can do everything a person can do, but we can't do everything to a corporation we can do to a person. We can fine one. We can't throw it in jail. So if the offense is heinous, let me finish. Well, if the offense is heinous enough, they can do what's called piercing the corporate veil. And then you go after the board of directors. But the rights and the duties in a corporation are separate. In you and I, they're the same. That's why they call us individual. And the word individual comes from the root word indivisible, because the rights and the duties are in the same entity.
Now,
you might have to work with that. You might have to work with that a little bit, but that's the definition of a legal person. Now, I'm going to tell you, I've been in this Patriot shooting match for 30 years, okay? And I've come in contact with a whole bunch of legal researchers over that period of time. And I've got one litmus test question I want to ask them right before we start talking about anything to see just how well they know what they're talking about. And that is, what's the legal definition of the word person? And every one of them, without exception, over all that time, came back with that answer. It's a corporation. And that can be correct, but it's not correct, because it can be a partnership, a trust, and all kinds of these other different entities. So that is a big failing in our community.
Too, right?
You know, we got a guy running around out there. I won't mention his name. I had him on my show one time, and we got into almost fisticuffs on the show about this, because he's going into the Bible. You don't want to be a person. Excuse me? Everybody's a person of some sort legally. You got your, you know, if you file an affidavit and you're under God's laws, you're a person because you get God's law rights and you owe God your duties. Well, it doesn't mean you're not a person. The question is not, are you a person? The question is, which person are you? where do you receive your rights and get your duties? When you file this affidavit, you're not a federal 14th Amendment person anymore, like all persons born or naturalized in the 14th Amendment. You're out of that because you get your rights from God and you owe to God your duties, but that doesn't mean you're not a person.
That cleared it up. That cleared it up. Now, he's talking firearms. Yes. Now, if I understand a firearm, according to the National Firearms Act 1934, was a fully automatic machine gun, meaning you hold the trigger down, it spits bullets out as fast as the gun's designed to spit them out.
What's the key thing? What's the key thing you said right there? 1934. 1934 comes after 1933, and that's when the system changed, and that's why they're bringing all those regulatory stuff in, and for them to bring that in that early shows how damn scared they are us having weapons.
Well, the other two criteria, one was a silencer, that's a firearm, according to that act, and a shotgun or rifle with a barrel less than 18 inches, overall length of 26 inches.
Randy Weaver.
All those three things are considered firearms. Everything else is excluded.
Okay. Well, when you get you change your status, and none of that stuff applies anymore because you go to look at at Title 27, which is BATF, Code of Federal Regulations, and on the first page they're going to have their jurisdictional statement, and their jurisdictional statement in Title 27 is residence.
I'm fixing to get to that. Now, I spent a month in D.C. around 2010. I had to go through Homeland Security to get a ID card, picture ID card, to get into certain places at the Library of Congress. And I'm not there as a tourist. I'm there as a researcher. And then I had to go through Homeland Security again to get another picture ID to get in the National Archives up in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, they don't want people in those places. They might find something.
It's the driest and boringest crap you ever want to get into, But I did get the stuff I was looking for because, you read all kind of crap on the Internet and you go, that can't be true, Well, a lot of that stuff I figured out was true. Now, I also spent a lot of time in my state archives and got, the 1927 Motor Carriage Act. And it talks about in there, if you're not on the road for commerce, you don't have to be licensed.
Oh, there's tons of case law on that now.
And that's the original Motor Carriage Act. Now, maximum of law, one of them states that the principal part of everything is the beginning. Well, that was the first Motor Carriage Act, so if you want to know about the Motor Carriage Act, you go back to the beginning.
Yeah, it reminds me of Al Addis, Animals,
Yeah, I've had some success in the courts here with that. I have the complete Alabama code books. I got Federal Digest books. I got Black's Law Dictionary, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th.
I want you to do me a favor. Go into the Alabama codes and go over into the section in the driving part where it talks about residency. And they should have this
title
statement
30,
in there.
Okay, 32.
Whatever. All right, whatever it is. And they'll say the first one is, you've been in the state longer than 30 or 60 days or whatever it is. And then there's another paragraph with some gobbledygook in there. And then underneath it in Georgia, underneath it, there's one line. The term resident is a rebuttable presumption. It's right there in their law books, okay? Go look.
Okay.
See, what I understand is the way they formulate these laws, they all call them uniform traffic code, uniform building code, uniform commercial code, because that way all the states have the same thing and they can control from the top down. That's why they do it like that. So if that's in Georgia, it's in every one of your state law books in the statutes around residency in the traffic section. You go check and see if that's there. Now, I'm running out of time here, Keith. I think I got somebody okay. else. Sam, hold on. No. Sam, is there somebody else in line? Okay, well, I'm going to talk to Sam, Keith, but you call in again when we got more time to talk, and it's good to talk to one of you Abilama folks over there.
Yeah, the question was going to be about getting my status corrected, but I'll do okay. that next week.
Well, you can do that, or you can call in on our regular daily show. We're on 6 days a week, so you're welcome to do that, too. So thank you, Keith, and you call in next week if you want to. We'll be here. Who's the next guy? Sam in Texas. Hey, Sam.
How you doing?
Pretty good.
Question is, do you know anybody in American National who's discharging money out of their security trust?
I don't know anything about that, and I'd advise you not to look into it because I've never seen anybody be successful at it. I think that's Patriot crap, okay? And they're not American nationals. According to all the paperwork, the federal government, you're either a national or you're a U.S. national. They don't have American national. They don't have state national. They don't have any of these other adjectives that our people want to stick on that term. Use their term in their situation, and you're using the key to the matrix. You bring in these other terms, and you may not be so successful.
So it's a national that you want to become.
Or U.S. national. I've seen it both ways. Okay, but I've never seen it American national. I've never seen it state national. I've never seen it national with a crooked walking stick. I've never seen any of that stuff, but those two. And using, now that we know their tricks, and now we know the definitions that are associated with those words, using those exact words are the key to the matrix. If you want to differ and you don't want to be successful, you go do what you want. But if you do, you're leaving yourself hanging out, in my opinion.
And so you've never heard of anybody successfully discharging any money out of their account?
I have not. I've never looked into it. I think it's foolish. But if you want to try it, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I've heard a lot of people say it. I'm not going to fight about it.
Have you ever seen anybody show you the check they got?
My neighbor and I did it with his account. And and 2 weeks later, it came back saying... I forgot exactly what it said. You don't have access to this account. And so, you know, he had the money to back it up anyway. We were just experimenting. But
You know, I hear people wanting to go and get money back from their mortgage and stuff. I have heard of people early on taking the fact that their mortgage is based on fraud because the financial institution never loans you any money because of the process they use. You actually loan them your signature on a promissory note that is now commercial paper that they're using as money because you signed your name to a future income stream. I have heard of people winning and getting their house keys, and the case is always put under seal, but that was years ago before the 208 fiasco, and I don't know if it'd work now.
What about the land patent?
Yeah, that works.
Okay.
I don't know much about it. It's not, you know, listen, I got a specialized feel, and that's your political status. And that's what I put all my focus on. I know it like the back of my hand. I don't know these other stuff, and I'm not going to get diffused off researching them.
First time I think I listened to you today. What did you say UCC stand for?
Uniform Commercial Code. That's the Babylonian Merchant Code. For thousands of years, it was called the Law Merchant. They changed the label to the Uniform Commercial Code. Same thing. In the Uniform Commercial Code, I hear the music, Sam. Hold on. In the Uniform Commercial Code, it says anything not covered by this title reverts back to the Law Merchant. That's what it is. We're done? I think we're out of time. Okay. Thanks. Bye-bye. See you next week. Thank you. You too.
And you won't have to worry about throwing away valuable groceries ever again. Our food is completely GMO-free, and our stringent quality controls, plus testing for heavy metals, makes us unique in the storable foods market. Simply Clean Foods' primary focus is to bring clean food to people all around the world and change the way we look at freeze-dried food in our daily cooking. When you purchase from Simply Clean Foods, not only will you be receiving high-quality food, but you will also be supporting veterans in need across the country and those who are affected by natural disasters.
Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on Long-Term Food Storage in the rotating sponsors banners to support RBN.
Simply Clean Foods. Do it today.
You're listening to Real Talk Radio, only on the Republic Broadcasting Network.